This is Jen Psaki. For the latest episode of Diplopod, I sat down with Carnegie Senior Fellow Kareem Sajjanpour and former BBC reporter and Carnegie Senior Visiting Scholar Kim Gaddis to talk about the long-standing rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Kim happens to be working on a book about the impact of the rivalry on the region since 1979, and Kareem is one of the most respected experts on Iran and U.S. policy toward the Middle East, so we had a lot to talk about. Well, Kim and Kareem, thank you for joining us in the Diplopod studio. I just want to start with a little bit of history. So, Kim, how much of the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is about religion, and how much of it is about political and economic struggles?
I think there's no doubt that the historical schism between Sunnis and Shias is there. It's a reality, and people have strong opinions about it, and it has been a factor of life in the Middle East and the wider Muslim world. But the Saudi-Iran rivalry at its heart, I think, is very much a political power struggle for hegemony in the region. And after 40 years of this rivalry unfolding in the region, starting with the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the sectarian elements of it have become quite strong. So it started as a struggle for power, for hegemony, for leadership of the Muslim world. And over the course of 40 years until, you know, as we see today unfolding in the Middle East, it has become sectarian and violent, with both sides using the sectarian elements to further their own political goals.
And Kareem, and Kim was referencing kind of how it's changed over the last 40 years. So obviously this rivalry impacts other countries in the region. How have their loyalties changed over the last 10 or 20 years as it relates to Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Well, if you look at the bloodiest conflicts in today's Middle East, whether it's Syria, Yemen, Iraq, to a lesser extent Lebanon, Bahrain, they are all embroiled in this broader Saudi-Iran rivalry. Saudi Arabia and Iran are supporting opposing sides of this rivalry. But it's important to accentuate Kim's point that this is much more driven by geopolitics rather than ancient hatreds. In the 1970s, Iran and Saudi Arabia were both monarchies, which very much feared Soviet Union and the communist threat. They had common fears about Arab nationalism. And so they were actually aligned throughout much of the 1970s. But it was when the revolution of Iran happened in 1979, when this competition for power and influence in the Middle East and the Muslim world grew much larger. And I think one of the reasons why you don't at the moment see great efforts by either Tehran or Riyadh to resolve their differences is that Saudi and Iranian citizens aren't the ones who are really suffering as a result of the rivalry. There's been over a million casualties in the Middle East over the last decade, but it's been mostly Syrians, Yemenis, and Iraqis.
That's an interesting factor I think most people don't think about. So I want to go to sort of how the perception of this rivalry that you alluded to is thought about within the countries. So in Iran, which you've studied quite a bit and spent time doing a lot of analysis on, how do the Iranian people think about the quote-unquote rivalry with Saudi Arabia? Are they concerned about it? Do they think it's overblown? Or how much do they even think about it?
Well, I think Iranians have certainly a cultural superiority complex towards the Saudis. Iran sees itself as an ancient superpower. You know, it's a country with 2,500 years of history. And they frankly look down at Saudi Arabia as a country with less than 100 years history as a nation state, a country which doesn't have Iran's civilizational history. So there's this paradox in that there's kind of this Persian superiority complex towards the Saudi Arabs. But there's at the same time kind of a Sunni Saudi superiority complex towards Shia Persians. But the reality is that when you ask Iranian officials about this rivalry, they'll certainly blame Saudi Arabia for the region's ills and for supporting al-Qaeda and Sunni radicalism. But Iran sees itself as a much greater power than Saudi Arabia. So they'll say, we're not rivals. We, they don't belong in the same league that we do.
And Kim, I think just you don't have to give the exact other perspective, but since you've spent a lot of time reporting on the region and in Saudi Arabia, what is the perspective in Saudi Arabia and from other regional powers on Iran or the rivalry between them?
So I was just in Saudi Arabia recently in February. And it's interesting, it was interesting to me to hear from Saudis, young Saudis that I met, that they weren't really comparing themselves to Iranians or looking at what was unfolding inside Iran, because there are actually some parallels when it comes to social changes or demands for social changes between the two countries. They're very different, as Karim said, but there are also certain parallels. And it was interesting to me to see that Saudis weren't really looking at Iran as something they wanted to compare themselves to or emulate or oppose necessarily. They were looking more to the West as something that was an example for them. And I'm talking more about society. You know, if you talk to experts or politicians or officials, they will talk about Iran as a competitor, a rival. You know, we've had the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, compare the Iranian supreme leader to Hitler because he says that, you know, it denotes Iran's desire to expand in the region. They see this as a great threat. And then a new line I've heard from some Saudis is that, you know, Iran is not a rival to us. We're bigger than this. We're better than this. We have America on our side. We have a much more modern country, a much more modern economy, a much more modern army. And Iran is not pushing against us. It's pushing back against Western imperialism in the Middle East. So it's not a direct competition. The reality is that I do think they're competing for power. And as Karim very aptly points out, the price is being paid by people in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen. And just to go back to what we were saying at the beginning of the conversation, the whole, you know, ancient hatreds that officials in the U.S. or in the West like to point out as the reason why this conflict is intractable. You know, I grew up in Beirut in the 80s. The words Sunnis and Shias, you know, they were not used. You know, we didn't think in those terms. And that applied across the Middle East. It is over time, as both sides, both Iran and Saudi Arabia, tried to rally people in their camp, that they started deploying this terminology. And that's why I think it's important to reframe this as a geopolitical battle, because that means that a solution is potentially possible in the future. You know, I don't know how we define it, but if you define it as an intractable hatred, intractable conflict that has gone on for millennia, then there is no end in sight. And I think that would be a shame and a disservice to the people of the region.
And very depressing as we look at geopolitics and stability. So you mentioned Mohammed bin Salman and his rise, of course. How have, you know, his rise or changes in leadership in Iran and Saudi Arabia and across the Middle East, even in the United States, how has that contributed to or changed the dynamics in this rivalry?
I think that, you know, again, speaking to Iranians and Saudis over the course of the last few weeks, I've noticed that Iranians, and, you know, I'd be very curious to hear Karim's point of view, it seems to me that Iranians are a little bit taken aback by Mohammed bin Salman's approach to things. He's much more forceful, much more bullish about pushing back against Iran influence in the region. And over the course of that 40-year rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia, I think the Iranians always expected that the Saudis were always looking for consensus, always looking for ways to appease things, even when there were big flare-ups in the region, even when there were attacks on Saudi territory that were blamed on Iran or allies of Iran. The Saudis always took the sort of consensual approach to trying to resolve the conflict. And now suddenly the Iranians look at Mohammed bin Salman and they see a man who's willing to take them on. And I think that has unsettled them a little bit. On another level, on a social level, I think, interestingly enough, even though, as Karim pointed out, there is perhaps the sense of superiority because of Iran's history, Iranians, young Iranians, especially women, are looking at Saudi Arabia and thinking, wow, that very conservative kingdom is allowing women into sports stadium. Mm-hmm. The crown prince has just said that, you know, as long as you dress modestly, you don't need to wear the hijab or a black abaya. And that is something that Iranians are noticing because they're in the middle of pushing back against some of these social restrictions, including the mandatory hijab.
And I'd say that, you know, these the two leaders in Saudi Arabia and Iran, Mohammed bin Salman and Riyadh, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and Tehran, are really a study in contrast. Mohammed bin Salman is a young, impulsive, pretty modern-looking 32-year-old presiding over a quite traditional society. Ali Khamenei is a 78-year-old, mm-hmm. very traditional leader mm-hmm. presiding over a much more modern society. And Saudi Arabia's vision for the future, they call it Vision 2030. You know, I call Ali Khamenei's vision 1979. He wants to basically preserve the principles of the 1979 revolution. And I think the Saudis at the moment feel the wind is at their back because the Trump administration is very much supportive of them, whereas the Obama administration tried to talk about kind of a power-sharing agreement between Tehran and Riyadh. President Obama famously said these two countries need to share the region. President Trump has in many ways gone back to status quo ante of supporting Saudi Arabia and containing slash countering Iran.
I would just add one thing. I mean, I think it's also important to point out that Mohammed bin Salman's sort of bullish attitude to the region is also being seen in the region as a way that as an approach that is perpetuating conflict. I mean, you look at Yemen, you look at Syria. They've not managed to counter Iran's influence by, you know, solving these conflicts in a way. You know, we look at Mohammed bin Salman just, you know, going home with $670 million in arms purchases. Mm-hmm. That is worrying to people in the region who have suffered so much. And you can start to apportion blame as to who is more to blame for what's going on in Syria or what's going on in Yemen. I think both countries need to take responsibility for what their approach to these two conflicts have wrought on these two countries. And try to find a way forward that is more peaceful. I know I'm, you know, sounding very, very naive, perhaps, but this cycle is never ending.
We are the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Yes. So you're talking about the right thing. So let me ask you about the prospect of military conflict, because you've obviously referenced Yemen, Syria, ongoing conflicts in the Middle East. Is there any scenario where people should be afraid of a military conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Or that's really not the focus? Hasn't been reported as such, but I figured I'd ask you while you're here.
I'll tell you that the danger is more proxy wars.
Proxy wars. Mm-hmm.
Iran has its proxies and, you know, the Assad regime, Shia militias in Iraq, Houthis in Yemen. Mm-hmm. They like to outsource this type of thing. And the huge advantage Iran has over Saudi Arabia in these proxy wars is that almost all Shiite radicals are willing to fight for the Islamic Republic of Iran, mm-hmm. whereas Sunni radicals, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they want to overthrow the government mm-hmm. of Saudi Arabia. So there's an asymmetry there, which is very much in Iran's favor. And I do think the prospects of conflict have gone up significantly, but it's not necessarily a Saudi-Iran conflict we're so focused on these days. It's more the United
Proxies.
States or the United States and Iran, or frankly, you know, Israel and mm-hmm. Iran and Syria.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked yet, but we will now, about the role of the United States. We always are central to that as it relates to reporting, at least on this side of the ocean. So President Trump has clearly shown an affinity for Mohammed bin Salman. They've developed a friendship cross age barriers, I suppose. How much does that matter? How do people watch that or view that in the region? You referenced military contracts. You know, there's other assistance that's been given. How do people view that?
In the region, I think that if you are in the Saudi camp, you view that as a great victory. Mm-hmm. You view that as the way that is going to enable the Saudi camp to, I don't know, overpower the Iranian side. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, even in Lebanon, you know, young, progressive, liberal Lebanese, not even just Sunnis, but also Christians who are opposed to Iran's policies in the region, who say, well, if Saudi Arabia can give Iran a bloody nose, good for them. And so during the Obama administration, when people felt that, rightly or wrongly, whether that perception was right or wrong, that Iran, that the United States was kind of siding with mm-hmm. Iran or making it easier for Iran to promote its interests in the region, they feel that now the pendulum has swung back, you know, that what was happening during the Obama administration was to Iran's advantage, that it was to Saudi Arabia's disadvantage, to the disadvantage of Sunnis, and now, you know, things are going back to how they should be, and that the Saudi camp has the backing of the United States and can perhaps try to curtail Iran's agenda and interests in the region. But again, you know, that raises concerns about whether this will further feed conflict if the Saudis feel that their approach to curtailing Iran's agenda in the region is by, you know, feeding more conflict.
Mm-hmm. You know, Kim made a very important point earlier about kind of the double-edged sword of Mohammed bin Salman's youth and impulsivity. So on one hand, he can get up and say, women should be allowed to drive, and I think we should in some ways encourage those progressive impulses he has. But then on the other hand, he can launch a war in Yemen, which has been disastrous for the citizens of Yemen and hasn't, you know, been good for Saudi interests either. And I think a 32-year-old leader needs allies and friends who will give him kind of tough love at some times and strategic advice without pulling punches. And I think the danger in Donald Trump is, you know, he's not a president who has that type of strategic or foreign policy aptitude. And he seemingly views the American relationship, I'm talking about Trump, views the American relationship with Saudi Arabia as purely transactional. You know, they're just this big, giant gas station that we can sell arms to. And we will just, you know, back them up 100% in their various fights. And, you know, that's not what a good ally does. It's not just kind of pure indulgence, the same way you don't indulge, your child by just feeding them candy. And so I think that I think it's a mistake to look at Iran and Saudi Arabia as a U.S. foreign policy professional and say, okay, we have to choose a team here. Mm-hmm. There's the Lakers versus the Celtics. Which team are we on? In reality, you're trying to kind of encourage the modern impulses in both societies. In Saudi Arabia, then in some ways that may be from the top up. In Iran, it's kind of the bottom up. It's society which is pushing it, and kind of discourage these more regressive impulses. And that requires a nuance which this administration hasn't exhibited.
Neither the president himself nor the people he surrounds himself with, right? I think that what we see in the administration is increasingly the president surrounding himself with people who would like to take on Iran. And I think that even for people in the region who would like to take on Iran, there is some concern about what that might end up looking like.
Which is this impulsivity, that an unpredictability. So you touched on sort of who he surrounds himself with. In the last couple of weeks, there have been major changes to his national security team. Obviously, Rex Tillerson's departure with the nomination of Mike Pompeo and General McMaster's departure to be replaced by John Bolton. Now, here in the United States, there's been a very alarmed reaction across partisan lines. How is, you know, John Bolton, Pompeo, the change in leadership viewed in terms of what that means for the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with other countries in the region?
I find the Bolton appointment as National Security Advisor to be perhaps the most disconcerting, distressing piece of news in the foreign policy realm since the Trump administration began, because he has probably been the single most outspoken advocate of military force, casual military force, in the Washington foreign policy establishment, whether that's against North Korea or against Iran. You know, a lot of folks who've served in the military, people like Mattis, McMaster, think about the use of military force as the last resort. Bolton has often written about it as a first resort. And so I think you want in the National Security Advisor someone who is going to really help synergize the views of various branches of government to present to the president a range of options. And there are models from both Republican and Democratic administrations that have worked very well. One that comes to mind is Steve Hadley, someone who is kind of widely regarded on all ends of the policy spectrum. But John Bolton is kind of the antithesis of that, someone who is deeply dogmatic. He already has his views made up. He's left a long paper trail. And, you know, what's worrisome, reading the writings of colleagues who work with him, is that he actually does have so much experience as a bureaucratic operator that he could actually be effective in forwarding some of these ideas, which could drag the United States into a conflict which very few American citizens want.
I think Karim said it all. I think it is concerning also for people in the region. It may, you know, give heart to those who are looking for confrontation with the U.S. in Iran. I mean, I think of also Iran's allies in Lebanon, for example, the leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who remembers John Bolton quite well from back in the day when he was serving. I think those tendencies, and I think that's what's worrying about what we see unfold on a global stage. I know we're talking about Saudi Arabia and Iran, but sometimes I think that the worst tendencies are being fed by this positioning on the extremes, you know, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, and now also in the U.S., where there's very little effort to find any middle ground anymore. And if you have a national security advisor like John Bolton, you're definitely not looking at the middle ground anymore. You're looking for confrontation. And some people thrive on confrontation. And I think that groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, or, you know, the Supreme Leader and the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in Iran, thrive on conflict because it helps them to solidify their grip on the people.
Well, thank you both for your insight and for your perspective from the region and from the United States as well. And hopefully we'll have you back again in the Diplopod studio again soon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Episodes of Carnegie's Diplopod are available from Carnegie's website, carnegieendowment.org, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume podcasts. Follow us at Carnegie Diplopod. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.